Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. You're listening to KZSU, Stanford University. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And thank you for listening today. Today I'm very pleased to have on Carrie McLaren and Charles Starr, the two people behind some very interesting work being done in the copyright and arts area. Primarily, they are sponsors of the Illegal Art Exhibit, as well as Stay Free Magazine. And I will allow them a greater opportunity to introduce themselves and so that we can have a better idea of who we're talking to and what everything is about. But I wanted to really just start off today and just kind of give everyone an idea of what we're talking about on this program. The theme of many shows leading up to now have been on the impact of copyright on various forms of creativity. So I interviewed Joanna Demers, a professor from USC, regarding her book Steal This Music, about the ability of copyright to impact music creation. I've interviewed Professor Lessig here at Stanford regarding the general impact of intellectual property law and technology. And I've interviewed several other people who are all focused on one way or another on intellectual property issues in the world of the arts. Today, we're going to be discussing the Illegal Art Exhibit. And the Illegal Art Exhibit, which whose website is illegal-art.org, identifies itself and calls itself a freedom of expression in the corporate age, quote-unquote, project, and have done a tremendous amount of interesting stuff sponsoring and working with artists who are pushing the envelope in one way or another regarding copyright. So we're going to go into some of the details there and kind of learn more about what it is that Illegal Art's about, who's involved, what the reactions has been, why it's been done, etc., as well as the related, I believe, magazine Stay Free, which is a really hilarious social commentary and media commentary magazine out of Brooklyn. Again, kind of tie those two together and see where they're going. So I'm very excited to have Charles and Carrie on today, and I look forward to a stimulating discussion. This show is being recorded literally an hour or so, hour and 15 minutes before it actually goes on the air, so it's pretty fresh for a recorded show, and I'm excited about delving into these issues. So when we return from a short music break, we'll talk to Charles and Carrie. If I've done my job properly, Charles and Carrie are with us now. Are you there?
We are.
Hi, Dave.
Excellent. Well, then this is a new foray for me. I'm doing a conference call by telephone, so I appreciate your indulgence and your patience. Why don't we start off really, because I'm sure I didn't do justice to introducing you, so I won't do your standard moderator thing and just call out names, but why don't you give us each a brief introduction of who you are and how you got to discussing something like this today?
You have to pick one of us because we're not going to. But I'll start. We started. Stay Free started the Illegal Art Exhibit. I think it was about 4 years ago now, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And the whole point of it was really to try to, you know, we were reading about copyright and knew about some of these issues, and we wanted to do something that would be accessible to the larger public. I mean, a lot of internet nerds have read about copyright, and they know about a lot of issues involved. But we thought that by showing some of the actual artwork that had run into legal problems and other kinds of problems with censorship, we could kind of put a human face on these issues and really show people the kind of stuff that is being jeopardized by the expansion of the copyright cartel. So, I mean, that's how we started, and it's the Illegal Art Exhibit is multimedia. We have film and music and visual fine arts and all kinds of things, and so it's been a traveling show. The website is actually up, but it's kind of lame because I haven't updated it in a long time. But that's a little background on that. And then Charles, do you want to say something about your role?
Yeah, sure. I think it's how I got involved. Is it safe to say that I fell into it when I met Carrie? I mean, I've always been something of an intellectual dilettante, and so I had some interest in copyright issues because, you know, when I was sort of an active lawyer, those kinds of issues would come across my desk. But the involvement in illegal art and, you know, actual sort of really caring about these issues came with increased exposure to it through my work with Stay Free and Illegal Art, you know, in the last 3 years since I met Carrie. And it's been really interesting to see all of the, you know, I'm not really necessarily conscious all the time of the music around me, but just seeing how much different things like hip-hop are, you know, in the last 20 years since copyright has, you know, copyright enforcement and rights enforcement has changed what can be allowed in sampling and that sort of thing.
So, Charles, you're an attorney, and like me, you've gone from being an attorney to doing something a little different, although I believe you've gone in a much further direction than I have away from being a practicing lawyer. I'm merely a fellow at Stanford, still involved in law heavily, but you want to tell us briefly what you're doing right now?
Well, yeah, I mean, now I'm a stand-up comic, and it's a sort of interesting perspective to approach this from, just because there's so much going on with all of the new media, on web media, on iPod, on all of this, where all of these industries are looking to get sort of cheap new comedy talent, and I watch kind of the newbies like me, who essentially give away everything for free and retain almost no rights in their material. I mean, they have the right to keep performing it, but they give it away without being paid for it. And it feels in some ways like, you know, the music industry of 60 years ago, where people would just get paid. Is everyone still there?
No, we're all here.
Yeah, okay. I just lost a lot of background noise. Where no one...
There is a lot of background noise.
I'm not hearing it on my end. Is it unlistenable for you?
No, I just wanted to let you know that there is a lot.
I appreciate it. Yeah, we're on this end, it seems to be running fine.
Okay, great.
Let me turn a little bit to just kind of contextualizing what Illegal Art is, and then turn to Stay Free a little later in the show. Taking a look at the website, it was an interesting description of the Illegal Art exhibit. And starting with the logistics of it, which I'm curious about in terms of what it is, and you started talking about in the introduction, Carrie. The website says, and I'm just quoting, the Illegal Art exhibit will celebrate what is rapidly becoming the degenerate art of a corporate age. Art and ideas on the legal fringes of intellectual property. Some of the pieces in the show have eluded lawyers. Others have had to appear in court. Tell me a little bit about what the exhibit is and how it's constructed, and then a little bit about what you mean by degenerate art.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a couple main components to it, and one is the real world exhibit. When we travel to, you know, different cities, we've done, you know, I guess kind of a place-based thing where we have a gallery show that we have all these fine artworks that are being displayed, and we try to, you know, we'll put, what's an example? I mean, we have say the Bunny Hop cover that Matt Groening, that was kind of a ripoff of a Matt Groening illustration. We have some comic books, other comic books that have covers that have, you know, been threatened. We have, you know, Packer Jennings has done some really funny Pez dispensers using the images of fallen rappers, of hip-hop stars. And, I mean, there's just all kinds of things. A lot of it ties in with consumer culture and popular culture. And so we'll have that show, and then there will be, we'll do some film screenings around it. We show Todd Haynes' Superstar, The Karen Carpenter Story, which is a really hilarious, documentary telling about, Karen Carpenter's battle with anorexia using Barbie dolls. Hmm. That was kind of legendary for being threatened with a lawsuit and, you know, kind of sued out of existence. But so we basically, you know, our approach is just to kind of do these things. We did purposely select things that are kind of they are not super obscure. It's not like walking into you know, kind of fancy museums. A lot of the things are funny or satirical in a way that whatever people enjoy.
Right.
So we did that to, you know, again, to make it accessible, and it's kind of the easy thing that the press talks about. So that's one component of it. And then we have the website where we have a lot of these things that people can actually download online. So if they're not in the city, they can still have access to
the city being New York, just
the particular city.
Oh, any city, okay.
It started in New York. I mean, it's kind of funny. Like, it started in there. The original intention of Illegal Art was just to do it in New York City because just planning that show was exhausting and took up, you know, my life for half a year. And then after that show, like, people just loved it so much that people kept coming up to me and being like, I'll do it in Chicago if you ship it to us. And I'm like, okay. So that's basically, and that's really been the model, is like other people in other cities like calling me and just saying, you know, how much will it cost to move this here? And and then we just do some more legwork and get it to happen. So I don't know. I mean, I think in the real world too, it kind of, it's a good component for a lot of the more intellectual discussions of the issues behind it. I just think it's a good way to have kind of examples that illustrate different points in the copyright debates.
The website and what I've read about the Illegal Art exhibit really, really lists a number of very interesting visual examples of what you're talking about, and you mentioned a few there. I wanted to just delve into a couple, not in great specifics, but just to kind of contextualize what we're talking about here. The project that I think, you could tell me if I'm wrong, but that has gotten the most attention was the Tom Forsythe Food Chain Barbie photographs.
Right.
And that particular case is interesting. I'll allow you to describe generally what it was, but I wanted to ask you about it. This was a case that occurred several years ago at this point. And I know that just looking at the website that actually at the end of the day, Mr. Forsythe was able to win a motion for attorney's fees, which is pretty unusual, in a pretty significant amount. But what I wanted to ask you about really is how that particular case and how that particular issue fits into what you're trying to achieve with Illegal Art. In other words, how does the example of the Food Chain Barbie photographs fit into the larger goal of the Illegal Art exhibit?
Well, I mean, I think one of the most important thing I think about Forsythe's case is that he was able. I mean, well, first of all, let me step back and just say one thing that's unusual about this is he was outright sued. Okay, a lot of the artists in our show aren't sued; they are simply given cease and desist notices, or they're censored in some other way. There are ways to censor artists that don't involve actually going to court. A lot of times. You know, companies will threaten more than they will actually follow up. But that's not what happened to Forsythe. Forsythe was actually sued. Now,
for these
photographs that he took some Barbie dolls and he took photos of them in various sexual positions, kind of goofy things involving blenders and ovens and, you know, all kinds of kitchen gadgets and all that kind of thing. So Mattel, you know, obviously found this offensive, obviously considered it damning to Barbie's image. So they sued Forsythe. And now another thing that makes Forsythe unusual from a lot of other artists, too, is that he was actually able to get legal help to back him up in court. Now, sometimes people can get pro bono legal help you know, just for guidance or writing letters, but he was actually able to get someone to help him litigate, which is very unusual. So they, you know, with this case, they argued that Forsythe had a fair use right to using Barbie imagery in this way, that it was clearly parody, and he won. And he not only won the case, but he was given legal fees. The court ruled that he was would be able to recoup his legal fees from Mattel. And the reason they were able to do that is because they ruled that Mattel's claim was frivolous. And it was frivolous because Mattel should have known that he had a fair use right to this thing. And so I think that the import of this case is that it can kind of send a signal to these other companies. It was really, for a lot of reasons, this trend was already underway for different, you know, for reasons dealing with the internet and negative publicity and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. But it made, I think it's kind of sent a signal to other companies with these big properties to not take this particular route of suing an artist, because you lose the PR battle, one, but then you, you know, chances are you may not even, you know, win, you may not even win the case, and then it just bites you back another way. I mean, Mattel had huge legal fees on their own, and then they had to pay over $1 million to Foresight.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a pretty good, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, I see where it's going, because I think a similar case was handled by CIS, the Center for Internet Society, not too long ago, involving a gentleman who was running a site called FedExFurniture.com, where he took FedEx, Federal Express shipping boxes and literally built furniture out of them, a bed, a sofa, a table, and put it up on a website. And Federal Express basically did the same thing that you're describing, said that this was an illegal copyright infringement. And it's the same principle, I think, that you're dealing with in both of these cases, which is the use of copyrighted or otherwise protected information or descriptions or what have you in ways that are uniquely creative and that create a new work as opposed to simply copying it.
I think there are two sort of important distinctions between those cases.
Okay.
I mean the Tom Forsythe case, just like the case where Mattel, which apparently has very bad legal advice, who also sued the band Aqua for Barbie Girl
and lost
there as well. In both cases, they seemed to be taking the position that people couldn't use Barbie criticize Barbie
mm-hmm.
or to criticize Barbie's effect on the culture as sort of a bad role model or representative of sort of ditzy women or ditzy women as something desirable, right? And it was a very strange position to take, where they essentially took a piece of culture and said that you can't comment on it
mm-hmm.
because we own it. And the courts in both cases said that that's not what you get by creating something, by having an intellectual property right. FedEx, I think, seemed to be a much more sort of odd trademark infringement case
mm-hmm.
where I really don't understand what Federal Express's agenda was at all, because they didn't seem to have been put in a bad light in any way. I mean, the worst that could be said is that FedEx's boxes are so structurally sound you can use them to make furniture. And somehow they seemed to be freaking out over the fact that this guy was stealing boxes out of their shipping center.
Mm-hmm.
It was a case without an agenda that seemed even more silly and misguided, though not as politically pernicious, I think, as the Barbie case.
You know, you make a fair point, because what you're dealing with here is the political commentary associated with the with the Barbie situation versus the FedEx Furniture situation, which was I think you correctly put more just dealing with the issue of misuse of the boxes. And because I can't get into too many details, because CIS were actually the lawyers for the gentleman involved in FedEx Furniture. But I think it's a fair point that you make, and it kind of ties into a question that I had regarding some of the other items that are listed on the Illegal Art copyright page of the website illegal-art.org. And what I want to ask you about, Carrie or Charles, is you list one by Eric Duringer. I hope I'm pronouncing his name properly. But what he did apparently is duplicate every CD in his personal collection and repackage them in hand-printed numbered editions. My question there really is that an example of illegal art in a more strict sense than or in your opinion than what we're talking about with the Barbie case? I'm basing that solely on what's listed there. Were you protecting or interested in the cover art that was created for the discs, or were you arguing something more broad than that?
Well, I mean, it's important to point out that with the CDs that he copied, there was no cover art. When he copied them, there was no identifiable information to the CDs at all.
I see. Okay.
They were plain white. They had his name, and they were numbered. And so it was really more. It was a fine art installation. It wasn't something that was mass produced, and he was really kind of wrestling with issues having to do with identity and consumption, rather than making any kind of statement about copyright. I mean, I don't think, copyright wasn't really at the fore of his mind. And so one of the things that we're doing with this show, I mean, quite a few of the works in the show are expressly critical of whatever it is that they're copying, but other things, they're just tangentially related. And, I mean, part of what we're saying is that people should have the freedom to create and to express themselves, and
copyright sort of acts as a looming shadow for a lot of these people who aren't even aware of it. I mean, he wasn't thinking in terms of copyright issues when he made the art, because the idea of copying the CDs was not for the act of copying. Right, it was the music in those CDs was essentially incidental, and it could have been anything within those numbered boxes, but for the fact that he was identifying them as his own CD collection stripped of any identifying characteristic. And even then, this sort of incidental copying, which has nothing to do with the point of art piece, runs into copyright trouble because copying ends up being a part of it.
What's been the reaction to the illegal art exhibit, both from people who are involved, potentially involved in creating art, artists themselves, as well as the general public, who are the obvious audience for this?
People like it.
Well, that's good. That's a good start.
I mean, that's like, I don't know. I mean, it's a really boring answer, but I mean, I think the response has been, good enough to kind of keep it going I guess one thing is that some of the artists who were in the show, like, really never thought about copyright when they created their thing in the first place. Some of them never even had to think about copyright because they never ran into any problems, and that's kind of one of the things that we're trying to point out with the show, that it's just such a gray area. It's such a crapshoot. You really never know if you're going to get in trouble or not, if somebody's going to complain or not,
I did ask a super broad question, and I can narrow down and make easier, which is probably a skill that I should work on generally. let me ask a question that I think will elicit a focused response, as the poor question really does not generally give the best answer. Although I liked your answer, I didn't think it was particularly boring. So the more narrow question is, given your goal of trying to expose or show the potential impact of copyright on the creation of art, have you found or are you aware of anyone contacting you or expressing any concern at all, other than the actual owners of the copyright, like Mattel in the Barbie case, in saying, no, we think that this is something that should remain difficult to do? Or have you found generally that people are saying, wow, I can't believe that this stuff is illegal? Has there been any kind of sense of where that's gone? Or are people just walking in, as you're saying, and just enjoying it and moving on with their day?
It's like 99.9% people who are on our side agree with us. I mean, we've, and this is just from commentary about the exhibit on different blogs and different websites. I mean, there's always somebody. I remember there was a, we did do a blog post. Stay Free has a blog, and we did do a blog post. I think it was about when I interviewed one of the producers for Mad Hot Ballroom about their use of film, their use of music and how, and licensing music for that documentary, and just what a nightmare it was. And there was, I think, at least one, if not two people on that thread who were very defensive. They were, I guess, composers who didn't think it was outrageous to charge $10,000 for a one-second clip. Mm-hmm. So there was some debate there. There was some difference of opinion, and but by and large, most people are on our side. But, I mean, it also has something to say about the kind of people who read Stay Free, who follow these kind of weirdo alternative, you know, underground shows that mm-hmm. they're going to tend to.
I think we got more of a broad opposition. We linked to I think his name was Mark Chamberlain, who did Batman Watercolors, which put Batman and Robin in, which posed them as a gay couple, and had Batman posing in lots of sort of homoerotic ways, and NDC kind of went after him, or one of the galleries that was selling his work, with a cease and desist letter, and a lot of people either directly commenting on our blog or in discussions on comic chat rooms or whatever, were very protective of artist rights and, you know, protective of the original, excuse me, DC Comics rights to control the directions of their character without allowing further cultural commentary on it. So I guess people get most, there are some things where I guess people get sufficiently emotionally invested in, you know, in this case, I guess, in Batman as an unambiguously heterosexual hero, that, you know, that they would, well, in those cases, side with against an independent artist.
Mm-hmm. But I do want to make a point about that, and that is that I would have to go back and read it, so I'm not really sure what people say, but my memory of that debate about the gay Batman watercolors was that some people didn't like them because they did find it was in some ways sacrilegious to the image they had of Batman. But I don't remember them saying DC has a right to sue them, or they have the right to make the works not exist. I think that, I mean, one thing that there's a difference between saying a piece of artwork sucks or saying you don't think it should have been made, or you don't like it, or you disagree with it, and saying that the copyright owner or whoever should have a right to sue it out of existence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's we want people to continue to debate art and to continue to say, oh, that's derivative and stupid, and it's a total ripoff of something else. I mean, that's what those kinds of discussions should go on. I mean, I think that's the role of criticism, and that's the role of debate and all that kind of thing. I mean, in my personal view is just that the courts are just too blunt an instrument to make those kinds of decisions and distinctions. So, if somebody hated the gay Batman watercolors, I mean, that's a valid position to make. Just hating them doesn't mean that you also think that DC has the right to sue everyone who uses who does something with Batman out of existence.
How do you find the artists? Do they approach you? How did this all come about?
Different things. Some artists contacted us. Some things we actively sought out. So it's kind of a mix of things.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of its current status, I saw on the website that it's going to be in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
Actually, is it there now, or what's where could people find the live exhibit?
It is in Portland, Oregon, at the Pacific College of the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to get the dates. I'm a little I'm getting married in the next week.
And congratulations.
Thank you. And so the date of I just know that the date of the show is shortly is about now.
Well, I appreciate I should note that I appreciate the fact that that you're coming on the air in the wake of or not in the wake of but on the eve of just about your wedding.
Yeah.
That combined with the feedback that you've mentioned, I should thank you profusely for talking to me today. Let's take a quick music break, and when we come back, I kind of want to tie in Illegal Art to Stay Free and delve more into that, and also you know, Charles, talk a little bit about your experience dealing with the at being a comedian and dealing with some of the copyright and intellectual property right issues that are attendant to some of the work that you're doing. So when we return from a short break, we will continue the conversation with Charles Starr and Carrie McLaren of both Illegal Art and Stay Free fame. Before we return to Charles and Carrie, I just want to ask you if you like what you're hearing. And you can send me an email about it or what have you. But help make sure that KZSU can continue providing great programs without commercials to listeners all over the Bay Area. And that's, you know, I guess I'm including myself in the great programs there, but there's great programming across the dial here on KZSU. So I'm asking for a donation. For more information, email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.org or call us at 650-723-9010. And, of course, don't forget to keep on listening. So, Charles and Carrie, I assume you're still there, so we can continue the conversation. Let me talk a little bit and ask you a little bit about Stay Free. First of all, what is Stay Free, and how does it tie in, if at all, to the Illegal Art exhibit?
Well, Stay Free is a magazine that focuses on media and consumer culture. So Illegal Art, actually, it's a project of Stay Free. And I think, you know, copyright is, I mean, it's part of consumer culture. I mean, it's been a lot of the things that we've focused on in the show, the Illegal Art exhibit, we tend to kind of emphasize commercial icons and commercial things as opposed to, you know, artists suing other artists. We don't really do so much of that. There are a lot of cases where, you know, one artist doesn't like the fact that another artist's work, you know, resembles theirs. We didn't really focus on that so much as companies and corporations that sue artists and sue other kinds of creative people. And that is fitting with Stay Free, which is about, you know, we look at corporations and really just kind of this the effect of commercialization on the public sphere.
Is Stay Free, it's a magazine that I've seen, and I love it, and I could say, while I do know Charles independently through his brother, who was a friend of mine and remains a friend of mine at Cornell, so I should give that disclaimer, but notwithstanding that, I've read Stay Free, and it's really witty and interesting stuff, and I'm pleased to note that you can actually buy it here in the Bay Area at Tower Records over in Mountain View. So there's my little plug, you know, and without any payment or expectation of remuneration. But
while you're saying that, you can also subscribe at stayfreemagazine.org.
There we go. And I can say honestly, I recommend it. There's some funny stuff there. And I want to, in connection with Stay Free, and the blog, I wanted to ask you with regard to the blog itself, how does it support the print version of the magazine and vice versa? And it kind of ties into, you know, a general question that I have regarding the use of blogs by creative people. So I guess I can ask Carrie and Charles your thoughts on this. But the blog, it seems, is not only referred to on the Illegal Art page, but it also comments on the same issues. So I'm curious to know how you use the two to complement each other.
Well, the magazine only comes out once or twice a year, mm-hmm. so we're kind of limited in what we can cover for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
So the blog, you can just get, it's just more immediate. You know, if there's something that you're seeing, you can get it up right away. I mean, to me, that's the beauty of blogging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also you can write something short that you don't really have much of an idea for.
Right.
When you're in the magazine,
which is always dangerous, depending on who's going to read it.
Exactly. But I feel almost like blog writing was. I feel that is uniquely suited to the way I like to write, which is that I find it hard to just kind of develop and organize thoughts, you know, into a 1,200-piece essay, and it's just much easier to go with some, like, one-liner joke and a link and a picture.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So it's kind of like it suits my short attention span a little better than the magazine,
mm-hmm.
but, and it's a little more immediate, but, I mean, I like doing both. Charles?
Yeah, I think it allows for writing about different kinds of things. The magazine tends to have, if not a theme, at least sort of a through line in the last few issues. And a blog is allowed to be a little more free form because it's not read in one sitting. It's not, you know, it has to... There's a consistency of tone, but the topics can be a little more broad-ranging. And, you know, I think sometimes the politics on the blog are a little more overt mm-hmm. than they are in the magazine, because when something comes out every 10 months, the immediacy of sort of political opinion can be dampened, because how many issues... are you going to get the timing exactly right when you have the kind of, one, lead time that we have going into each issue, and two, the amount of time that the issue will itself be sitting on the shelves and, you know, placed in coffee shops around Brooklyn by Carrie and me. You know, if you're putting a six-month-old issue of Stay Free and Ozzy's on Fifth Avenue, I don't know that it's very good to have something, you know, tied to an election.
Right.
Well, I mean, one thing that I think blogs don't really do very well, that I think that the magazine does well, since I mentioned things that blogs do well, is history. You know, we do history, we do kind of more sociological fodder in the magazine, things where you want to kind of explore something in depth and we do a lot of, like, long form interviews and that kind of thing, and it's just not as, I don't know, I just don't think it's as adapted well on the web. People don't want to read something that's long and kind of.
Yeah, definitely. I think it definitely depends on the context of the blog. There are certainly academic or more scholarly oriented blogs where you have long entries, and oftentimes people will use their blog to test drive particular theories or ideas that they'll develop more thoroughly later, but I can see what you're saying with regard to either social commentary or art or what have you, that there are different formats to approach it, which kind of ties me into another question that I've asked a few other guests, including Larry Lessig and some other lawyers that I've had on, which is that many people, and I think I'm part of it, would say that it's unfortunate, by and large, that intellectual property concepts have been used in a way to squelch expression and to make it more difficult for people to create. And from the standpoint of both illegal art and Stay Free, which are obviously not efforts, or you can tell me if I'm wrong, but they're not efforts to directly address the law as much as to give, to either comment on the state of the world, or in the case of illegal art, to give outlet to artists that, as you mentioned, may or may not even be aware that they're dealing with an intellectual property issue. I'm wondering if you have an opinion generally on how intellectual property law is intruding in the kind of work that you're trying to do. You have artists here who are creating works that the copyright owners or trademark owners may in fact consider to be an illegal use, and yet they're going forward. And with regard to your magazine, you're commenting on this media culture. Do you have any opinion on the intrusion of intellectual property law here, and do you have any thoughts on where that's going from your perspective as creators?
Charles, you should answer that.
Well, I think it's a sort of tricky line to walk, because I don't know that I would necessarily say that, you know, Katie bar the door on all of this stuff. Like, I don't mind the aspect that artists get rewarded for their work, but I think that I think that mostly what you see is pressure to limit fair use and pressure to suppress criticism by people who have economic interest in suppressing criticism. And you see sort of very, very selfish interest in forgetting about artwork, but in using intellectual property to tamp down technology that has potential effect on, you know, distribution models of intellectual property. And all of those things are sort of, are, you know, bad and dangerous. And some of it, is not extra legal necessarily, but in the way that people control content in turning works of art or creations into work for hire, where artists are giving away, you know, long-term rights to their work for, you know, the proverbial mess of pottage, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of those things are just as tricky as the intellectual property question.
If you were to get the perfect response from a reader of Stay Free, in other words, someone who's read your magazine, read through the blog, and now you ask them, what is your reaction to it? What do you hope that people say after they read Stay Free, beyond saying, please let me know where I can buy the next issue? Which I assume would be the first thing you'd want them to say.
Well, the second would be, where can we buy Associated T-shirts? I suppose. No, I guess what we'd want is for people to be more conscious, I guess, of the world around them, to be more thoughtful about how these issues affect their lives. I mean, I guess I don't necessarily think that people have to agree with our positions on these.
I think they should.
Well, they should, because we're right, but
it always makes it tougher for people to disagree when you're right. Right.
But I think people should be more thoughtful about them, though, in a way that I think people should be more thoughtful.
We also want them to take some, I mean, it'd also be nice if they took some action, like, you know, responded to the EFF, you know, pledge drive and, you know, writing their Congress people and those kinds of things. I mean, we want to. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of like we get accused of preaching to the converted all the time, but the converted need to be preached to, because sometimes they just need a big kick in the pants to actually like do something based on what they think or what their beliefs are. Like, it's all good and. You know, it's all one thing to think something and to feel this way and to hate the copyright cartel, but, you know, take 5 minutes and call this number. I mean, those are the kinds of things that we'd like to get people to just realize that these are, like, really important issues and that it's worth taking a stand about. So. Mm-hmm.
And I think this ties into my last question before I ask you to just kind of give the listeners an opportunity to find out where they could access more information about Legal Art and Stay Free and what have you. But, Charles, you mentioned your transformation from a practicing attorney to comedian. And I had the opportunity to take a look at the clip of one of your routines that you have up on your MySpace page. And aside from enjoying it and continuing to appear like I'm a paid promoter of everything you're doing, what are your thoughts on your experience as a copyright as a person creating copyrightable materials and MySpace, uploading that video and dealing with some of the issues attendant to that?
Well, I mean, uploading the video was very interesting, because I am exactly the kind of lazy person who doesn't read the terms of use. You know, I don't have the patience. It says, do you agree to these terms? And I say yes, and apparently our firstborn now has to be named MySpace. But what I found out essentially through Boing Boing and a bunch of other bloggers who brought this up is that MySpace at the time had a very broad terms of use policy, which said that anything you upload, they can use.
Hmm.
Not only can they use it while you have it up there, but if you take it down and their systems had, for one reason or another, backed up the file and they have some residual copy, then they can keep using that residual copy. And that created an uproar, which, to MySpace's credit, and even, you know, as much as this pains me to say, I guess it's now a product of Fox. And so Fox is the one who did this. They responded to the uproar by, one, saying that they could see the nefarious reading, though it's not what they intended. And then they actually changed the terms abuse to reflect what they really meant it to be. So if you pull it back, they can't use it anymore. Though you still grant them some right to use it to promote whatever they want to promote while you have it up there, which I think is kind of the least you could do at some level.
Right.
But I see sort of what I see in my, you know, that's sort of the video aspect. What I'm seeing more often is, you know, with comics who are, like me, effectively amateurs. I mean, I play clubs sometimes, but mostly I'm performing at bars on the Lower East Side. Is a lot of companies, media companies, that look to effectively amateur comedians to provide them content with the promise of a very nebulous kind of exposure, with rights agreements that turn over perpetual galaxy-wide rights to use your work in any medium for all time.
Mm-hmm.
And because so many of the people who do this are either A, desperate for exposure, no matter how limited, and B, not at all versed in either economics or intellectual property or the value of their own words and ideas, see people very willing to just give away what people should fairly be paying for.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up not being a legal issue that can be dealt with by statute because it's all purely contract. They sign away their rights very willingly, and I think very foolishly, because comedy is a very much every person for themselves cutthroat kind of thing. Nobody is, you know, I guess there is a group called the New York Comedians Coalition who are dealing with some of these issues and trying to speak with a unified voice, but it's kind of a union that's very easy for content distributors and clubs to break. And so I'm not sure how strong it'll be ultimately.
You have you've covered so many issues there that I would have invited you back anyway to discuss them. But now that you've I think I can think of at least six follow-up questions I'd like to ask you. Unfortunately, we're coming towards the end of the show, so I want to certainly invite you back. And I won't put you on the spot to say yes right now. You can think about it and ruminate. But I'd like to invite you back to talk about your experience as both an attorney and comedian who's both versed in the law and creating the kinds of works that are subject to these restrictions, and get your thoughts on that. So I will leave it to a separate discussion to potentially set that up. In the last minute or so, why don't I ask each of you to take, you know, 30 seconds and provide the listeners with any information you want to provide as to finding out more about your respective projects. So, Charles, why don't we start with you since I was chatting with you?
The first is you can find the video clip and my comedy schedule, which is mostly restricted to New York, but I hope to have it a little broader someday at my MySpace page, which is myspace.com/Charles_Star, 1R. And you can see my very rarely posted to personal blog, which also has comedy schedule and other quirky things, at rickblaine.com, which is the Bogart character in Casablanca.
Huh. Carrie?
And Stay Free. We have a website, stayfreemagazine.org, and we have SPAC issues and illegal art fodder. We have illegal art CDs and DVDs and We have Wizard People, the Harry Potter spoof, lots of stuff there.
Danger Mouse's Grey album.
No, we don't have that. Do we have that still? We might. I think that somebody else has it online, so we stopped because it was killing our server. So that's safefreemagazine.org, and you can find a link to our blog there as well. And then, of course, as David mentioned earlier, there's the Illegal Art site, which is illegal-art.org.
Carrie and Charles, first of all, of course, congratulations on your events upcoming. I imagine that as soon as you get off the phone, it'll be back to figure out who's sitting where. I know that took me a few weeks. But I want to thank you for taking the time today to discuss these projects. I certainly invite both of you back to discuss them. I actually may very well be in Portland in the coming 6 weeks, and so maybe I'll get a chance to see the exhibit. But either way, I wish you luck in your respective endeavors. I think you're doing great work, and thanks for coming on today.
Great. Thank you.
Hey, my best to Heidi.
Certainly. Thanks. that was Charles and Carrie. Charles Starr and Carrie McLaren discussing the Illegal Art exhibit, as well as Stay Free Magazine and Charles's burgeoning world of being a stand-up comic. So when we return from a short music break, I will close the show. I want to thank Carrie and Charles again for being on and discussing the Illegal Art exhibit and Stay Free Magazine and the great work that they're doing. Next week, I am pleased to say that I will have Professor Tim Wu from Columbia University Law School on the show to discuss his book, Who Owns the Internet, and to delve into the world of how the Internet operates itself, who regulates it, how it can be regulated, and where we're headed. So I'm looking forward to that interview. And otherwise, of course, you can always find out more not only about me, but about the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School by checking the website, cyberlaw.stanford.edu. You can also hear the show as a podcast on iTunes, and I continue to inch more and more closely towards having a website dedicated to this show. So thank you again for listening. My name is Dave Levine. You're listening to KZSU Stanford. Please stay tuned for further programming here on KZSU, and thank you for listening today.